As listeners have heard, command decisions in the police investigation of Hakeem Clark's murder, specifically the decision to turn this investigation over to robbery rather than treating it like a potential murder, left gaps Agent Santoro had to fill. That decision almost cost the police its most crucial piece of evidence, though, Quezon Lee's fingerprint. I sat down with two of the best in the business, Jenna Rojas and Michelle Shiro, to talk about how inexperienced detectives and inexperienced forensics techs can make the difference between finding the truth and killers walking free. Take a listen. And welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond Reasonable Doubt. I am Christy Barker, and I am so thrilled because I have two amazing forensic people on at the same time. And regular listeners will know that I am the world's biggest forensic fangirl. So I have with me Jenna Rojas and Michelle Shiro together. This is so great. So first of all, if you would introduce yourselves, Jenna.
Hi, I'm Jenna Rojas, and I was blessed to work as a forensic investigator from 2014 to 2019 at Savannah Chatham Metro and Savannah PD.
Very, very cool. And with you tonight, we have Michelle Shiro. Michelle, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I started with the forensic unit in 2006 after the county and the city merged, and I retired in 2022 after 16 years.
So 16 years in forensics. What else did you do before that? I don't even remember.
Before forensics?
Yeah.
Well, I was just on patrol, and I worked in the jail for a time.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I brought you all here because I want to talk about forensic stuff. And of course, I brought you in the context of the investigation of the murder of Hakeem Clark, which was committed by Quezon Lee. He's pled guilty. I can say that. But part of what I wanted to do is a lot of people still like believe in what they see on TV on CSI and stuff like that. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what it is like to be a real forensic investigator. And you all worked together for a good chunk of time at Savannah. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So tell me first and foremost, and you can do it in however y'all want to do it. What kind of training did you all get to do that job?
So the first thing was I was hired because I had a bachelor's degree, and that I think that was one of the requirements. It was either that or bachelor or 2 years and experience. And then when you come in, you start getting field training pretty much right away. And I got to ride along with several different investigators within the forensic unit. And so you get to see the differences in how people process scenes or how they view things. And you get to have a wealth of knowledge from a variety of different people, and you can kind of shape your way of investigating through that. And then you can go to, I think it's 7 different courses through JIPSTIC.
Wow. Okay.
It would be great if Michelle could tell me, remind me of what that
Georgia Public Safety Training Center.
Thank you. So there's 7 different courses that you can take to become a certified forensic technician through the state of Georgia.
So what kind, are we talking about like what, scene processing? What are we talking about?
There's scene processing, evidence handling, 3 different fingerprinting classes, photography. And so you get a really well-rounded program that prepares you for processing those scenes in the appropriate ways.
So does everybody go to the classes? I always felt like a lot of people just got thrown to the wolves and here's the street, have fun.
Those classes were optional. But I love learning and I love challenging myself and trying to be the best at what I do. And so I went to all the classes. I didn't want to get
Fantastic.
on the stand and have a vicious defense attorney attack me for a lack of training or education or anything. So I wanted to be as pre well prepared as I could be.
It never stops them from attacking you anyway.
That is true. But at least they will have less to attack me about.
Right. They won't necessarily win the attack. They can just try. So, Michelle, did you take all those classes?
I did.
And then some.
Jenna and I had that in common. We both like the education stuff. So, yeah, when I first got to the unit, I, found out where the website was for Gypstick, and I planned out, what classes I was going to take when, and I went to my sergeant with a plan. I said, "Hey, I can be certified within 2 years. Here we go. Here are the classes." So,
Awesome.
yeah, same
And
kind of
then when
deal.
I joined, I came to her and I was like, I want to do this. And so she like sat me down and even gave me directions on how to get there and like what order to take the classes. And she like basically helped me make the plan. And I was just really excited and grateful.
Well, yeah, that's so much of what we talk about sometimes on this show is just like how important it is to have mentors or people you can actually go to and ask questions, like that institutional knowledge. And Michelle, you had how many years in by the time Jenna came along?
Eight.
Eight. It's a math thing. I can't do that in math.
Just in forensics, eight, right? 2000, were you 2006 forensics or 2006 in the department?
2006 to the forensic unit.
Okay, so I think eight then.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have picked a better person to mentor you, really, for forensics. But how much do you actually get to work with your mentor when you're in a department that, 'cause how many, let me back this up. Forensics, and I think we've mentioned this before, y'all got called out a lot. Is
Yeah.
that fair? Can
Yeah.
you give me any estimate as to like how many call outs you would do, like any given shift?
I could not at all. I know it was like a huge uptick in the summer, but I couldn't put a number on it. I just remember being like, when you are on call, you're probably getting called out.
Do you
And
remember, Michelle?
It varied because depending on how many people were in the unit, and then we had different schedules going on. At one time, we had two different lists of call out, one for regular, one for homicide. And then we had a supervisor that said, "Nah, you're all the same. You can all go out to everything." So it kind of depended. And I mean, you might be on call once every 5 or 6 weeks. And then you might get one or two call outs because we had shift coverage that went up until like 3 or 4 in the morning. And at one time we had someone who worked the night shift from 11 to 7. And so you wouldn't get called out unless things got really, really bad. So it really depended on the supervisor and the number of people in the unit. But I mean, I think that's a fair estimate. You'd probably get called out once or twice during the week.
I think it also depended on your specialty because I don't know if you did, I don't remember, but I was sometimes there were just the urgent matches needed to be made, and I would get called out just to do shell casing matches for NIBIN. So they would just call me to put it in the system because it
Yeah.
took a while to go through. So I wasn't sure if you also, I can't
Good
remember.
point. Good point on that because I forgot. Sometimes I would get called out just for fingerprints. I remember that one. It was St. Patrick's, and I was just about to go home. I was on the night shift, and there was a homicide. It was a shooting somewhere. God, one of the clubs, and I don't remember which one, but I remember Puhala was dancing in the street because he was going to close a bunch of cases because this guy was.
Izel Perry. Izel Perry. Yep.
If that's the right one, and I was on call, but I had been on River Street, and I thought I was going home, and the boss was like, "No, I need you to come over here and run these prints and see who we got. We think it's this person, but we need to confirm." And I know Detective Puhala was quite happy.
That it was factual. They that closed a bunch of homicides, definitely. He was
So
prolific.
there were times like that too.
So you guys actually had specialties, like things that you were assigned to as a specialty. So obviously, Jenny, you've talked about you did shell casings and Ivan. What did that entail? And just to clarify, for the world that doesn't know what Niven is, what are we
Niven
talking
is
about?
a database that's run through the ATF where you can match shell casings from crime scenes or recovered firearms, and you can run them against those that have been collected and put into the system throughout the entire United States and its territories. So that entails when shell casings come in from a crime scene, or if we recover a firearm, we will get shell casings from those firearms by shooting it in a tank, in a safety, in a controlled area.
You don't just shoot people in the in your workplace.
Yeah,
You
no,
just
yeah,
go out in the
definitely
parking
include that
lot.
sound effect because it's
Just do a
definitely more
desk pop. You do a desk
fun.
pop,
Desk
right?
pop, desk pop, right? So those come in and we will go through them to find, like, let's say we have 10 shell casings. You'll look at all 10 of them, determine how many different firearms were used within those 10, and divvy them up between the what, how many firearms, the caliber of those firearms, the make of each shell casing, because different shell casings are going to be made with different materials, and therefore the imprintation on them, the imprint on them will be different depending on the material. And then within those, you break it down even further and be like, okay, if I have the exact same shell case, or not the exact same shell, if I have two shell casings that are similar from the same firearm and made with the same materials, I have to decide which one of those to put in the system. Once you put them in the system, it will take hundreds of photos of it, and it will go into a correlation system, which means it runs against prints from across the nation, and it'll say, okay, I think these 120 other shell casings are possible matches to that shell casing. And part of my job was to go through and look at 30 from four different viewpoints. So the top 120, and if there's duplicates, then just keep going and see if yes, those are potential matches. No, that's not a match. Yes, no. And then once I've gathered those, I send out the potential matches to the detectives on the case and my and their chain of command. And then if they deem it to be necessary for the case, they can send it to the lab to get it approved by a ballistic expert.
And I'm stopping you just for a second, just because this is a really cool thing. A lot of times, I think my general knowledge of Niven had been like it's kind of like APHIS, like you just kind of put it in the machine and the machine does things. I don't think that it was very clear to me how much legwork is involved for you as just the person, like, I just put it in, but no, you also ha then have to look at the massive matches or the potential matches to see the level of accuracy. But it's such a great preliminary tool too. Like if you're dealing with, and we still are dealing with it in Savannah, you're missing out if you're not still in the area. We still are dealing with these groups that are shooting each other all the time. And the way weapons change hands and everything else, just following a weapon can be really very telling about what's going on in the community.
It was really interesting to be able to see the firearms and the connections across the city and how you can tell which side is being impacted this time and if they're sharing the same firearm. So they're just passing it from one person to another.
So, yeah, that we're going to come back to that because I just find that really a fascinating tool that probably is a lot more specific than I thought. But again, much like APHIS and much like CODIS, the machine can only do so much. So there's still a lot of need for a specialist like you. And obviously we've also I've had Brian Leppard and Kevin Rittman on just to talk about the ballistics because it is a very fascinating scientific area. So You would get called out for that. I know Michelle, and I've had Michelle on before to talk about fingerprints because she's the queen, as far as I'm concerned. The fingerprint thing, and of course, fingerprints are a lot more well known as a science for matching things at crime scenes. But fingerprints, you ended up doing like fingerprint matches for absolutely everything. Is that fair, Michelle?
Yes. Any scene where a latent fingerprint could be collected, whether it's recovered stolen autos, entering autos, burglary, theft by taking, whatever.
So, and I want to ask you this too. So, Michelle, you are primarily doing latent or just fingerprint comparison after what point in your career?
Well, I started shadowing Mikey before he retired, Mikey Hendricks. He retired in February of 2011, and that's when I went into the office and I had like that last month with him. And I said, "Look, I had been kind of, you can call it interning. I would sit in with him every Wednesday on the overlap day when we had a lot of people on the street, and I would just sit with him all day Wednesday. So by the time he re was getting ready to retire, I knew my way around the office pretty well, so I had that last month with him, and I said, "Look, just kind of sit back and relax, and just kind of watch me do everything, and point me in the right direction if I'm going the wrong way." So for that whole month, I had him there, and I was pretty much scared to death because I knew fingerprint matching, going to court and swearing about it—you're changing somebody's life. So I was pretty serious about it. But from 2011 until I retired in 2020. Well, I should say fairly from 2011 until we split from the city again in December of 2017. That was all straight fingerprint work. And with some little periodic stuff in crime scene. And then after we split and I went back to the county, then I was kind of doing still fingerprint work and some crime scene, because when we started out, there were just the two of us.
So from 2011, so at the time that we had this homicide, which was in 2015, you were primarily the fingerprint guru, right?
Yes.
How often would you get having or be asked to assist with processing stuff?
I mean, periodically, everybody in our unit, I think, was pretty well trained on processing. So they pretty much everybody kind of took care of their own cases. Once in a while, if we were short on a particular day, or if they just wanted some extra help, I would go out and help, but not usually unless I was asked.
Well, I kind of want to ask this too, because and you mentioned that everyone was pretty well trained on processing. When you are the fingerprint examiner, or primarily the fingerprint examiner, the quality of prints that come into you matters. Is that fair?
Yes.
And so if you have somebody who's, at the crime scene but is rushed, or it's not a great crime scene to begin with, or whatever, that can affect your ability to match. Is that also fair?
Yeah, I think a lot of factors go into it. Different people have different talents and skill levels, and certainly different people would turn in better prints than others. So you hopefully, when you're working a scene, you get someone who's really, really good at processing. They know where to look. They're good at doing the actual processing and lifting and then turning them in.
And you have to take into consideration, like, what are you processing and what is the weather like? Because if you go to a scene and everything is just covered in dew, it's going to be really important how you process that. because you could end up destroying evidence if you don't process it correctly. And if you don't
Yeah.
use a certain material when you're processing certain things, that's going to impact how you do it because there's a flow chart. And if you jump down a few levels on the flow chart, you can't go back and try something else. You have to going in order is ideal.
So help me out with that a little bit. Either one of you can jump in on this, but you mentioned it specifically, Jenna. I think a lot of us, lay people don't fully understand, like, you can actually process something that has dew on it. What do you mean? What are you talking about?
So there's different materials that we can process in different ways. And there's a massive chart that I have hanging in my office that has the whole flow chart and what types of material you should be using on certain surfaces. So if something is wet, you want to use the flow chart to document or to refer, you want to refer, sorry, oof, you want to refer to the document and go in order of the way it should be processed so that you don't accidentally destroy it, or maybe it doesn't work, but you've gone too far down the flow chart that you can't go back up and start again. So it's really important to just be conscious when you're going in to process something. I
So
don't know if I explained that well
no,
enough.
it makes sense. It just, it's interesting to me because it's like something you would want to have in a picture on your phone so that you could have it with you all the time. Just
Yeah,
like,
or
where
someone special on speed dial to be like,
am
hey, am I doing this right? What should I use? Or sometimes if it's really important, we can bring it back to the office and like you're usually collecting the evidence and then you can refer to the chart that's in the office and you have way more materials because not everything can be transported in your vehicle. So you'll have a lot more time and space and ability to process back in the office.
Okay. But you had like all of the tools that would be available to a forensic examiner or a forensic processor in the office, at least at a minimum.
Within reason, there are more expensive and more expensive processes that are not necessarily always needed. So it kind of depends on the department. So in a bigger department, you're probably going to have more crime, so you're probably going to need more materials. If you're in a city that or a town that mainly deals with cow tipping, you probably don't need as extensive as a
So you
inventory.
don't need Blue Star or
You don't need a
Numerol or
PR
whatever.
or anything.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. So you guys were dealing in volume, and I mentioned, and I'm really glad you brought up, Michelle, the just that you had everything from theft to homicide, because that huge range of stuff that y'all as forensics officers had to respond to. I mean, I'm sure there's a triage to it, like, hey, this one's urgent, this one's not, whatever. But that's a lot of stuff that you'd be called out to. I mean, you were talking about, oh, I'd be called out once or twice. It's like, it sounds like it would be more than that. Is that fair? Is that right?
Well, I'll tell you, I got called out a lot more after we split from the city, but that's because there were only two of us to start. So I think when we were combined as Metro, there were a lot of techs that they'd get called out first. I mean, Jenna, you may remember, didn't we have two lists at one point? One for regular call out and one for homicide. And I think I was on the homicide list, so they usually didn't call me first.
And we had people working until like 3 or 4 in the morning for the most part. So we're when we say we're getting called out, we're like, this is when we are at home. The everybody on the street is busy or short staff, so we're not getting called out for like every little thing. And if we do get called out, it's because there is a major violent crime happening. We're probably not getting called out for an entering auto. They're going to put that on the list and have us re respond that the next day because no one wants to be woken up yet again at 4 o'clock in the morning to get their vehicle processed because it's broken into. So we're the non-violent calls are probably getting held until the next morning when the first person is coming in. So if we're getting called out, it's a major crime. But if you're saying called out, like a call goes over the radio, yeah, we were We were busy. I think my record was 11 calls in a night.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty fair. Just in a standard shift, because you were still working 10-hour shifts, I think. So yeah, about a call an hour. That can happen sometimes. It was
Wow.
a busy night.
That sounds miserable. And it also sounds like 2015. So I brought you here, obviously, to talk about this homicide, this murder of Hakeem Clark. Jenna, you were the person who was called out to that. Is that right?
Yes.
Do you remember exactly how you got involved in it? I know like you must have had like zillions of calls. So does anything about this ring a bell? I know you refreshed yourself some.
I did refresh myself because we worked so many calls as we just talked about, and thankfully we still have the photos and everything. But I was working and I got called to an aggravated assault over the radio. So that's how so it's usually patrol will respond. Then they will talk to their supervisor. Supervisor talks to violent crimes, and either violent crimes or their supervisor calls forensics.
Okay. And this was, I think, if I have it right, July 25th, 2015. Is
Yes,
that right?
according to my report.
That sounds right to me. So you responded to where?
To 2 North Farm Street.
And that's the post office.
Yes.
That's the post office, Bay Street and Farm Street in Savannah.
Yes.
Close to downtown where everybody's going out to River Street and everything else.
Yep, it's a happening place.
You describe that area to me? I know I'm still going to call him Detective Santoro because that's what I do. I know he talked about this location, and it's not a perfect situation when you get called at night, period, but it's not incredibly dark where they were, is it?
No, I can see a bunch of street lights in the area. And I don't think I had to use a lot of flash in my photographs.
Okay. So when you got there, what was there? What was your crime scene looking like?
We had vehicles in the parking lot, and I don't see the evidence right away because the first thing I do is make contact with the first responders and the detective that's going to be in charge of the scene. So
Okay.
I'm not treading on anything. I want to stay outside of the crime scene area before I know what we're getting into.
So when you got there, and I remember Detective Santoro with Rob was talking about there being some dispute or some lack of clarity as to whether this was going to be treated as a robbery or a homicide. Who were you talking to when you got there?
The first person I made contact with was Detective Santoro, and usually it actually happens quite a bit. We don't know what it's going to end up being. Is it just going to be an aggravated assault? Is it going to be an armed robbery? Is it going to be a homicide? Like, scenes change pretty frequently. What we know at this time is that it's an aggravated assault, and so we rely on the detectives usually to make the decision on how it's going to be handled, and then we, in conjunction with them, make the decision on how it should be processed.
Okay. So when you talked to Detective Santoro, what was the thought process and how to approach this scene?
We're going to treat it as if it could be a potential homicide because we were unsure of the status of the victim at the time.
Okay. So because of that, and I have a feeling you probably would have done things pretty much the same way anyway. Because you've had a lot of crime scenes, and I know that we had some cases together. How did you approach this? What is it that you started looking for?
Well, first of all, I said homicide, and I should clarify, we were going to treat it as an aggravated assault because we didn't have any other information. So, aggravated assault, which is different than the processing for a homicide, which is different than the processing for an armed robbery. So, we're going into it knowing that someone has been a victim of aggravated assault, and the first thing we need to do is discuss what type of crime it is and what we're looking at in the scene so far and what the first responder knows so far, because I don't it's better to have everyone's perspective on it before I go into it, but I don't want to know so much information about the case that it gives me a theory before I can see the evidence. Because if you have a theory before you go into it, you try to mold the evidence around that theory. So you should go into it with the mindset of let my evidence speak to me and then develop your theory afterwards. So what I tried to do was listen to what they had to say and then go into the scene with an open mind.
Okay. And you did that here.
Yes.
And I'm glad you also mentioned that idea of maybe confirmation bias or something that could creep into it. Y'all are basically, and I think this is so true for law enforcement in general. And I was listening to a different podcast that was talking about you gather facts. You're not there to support one specific theory. You're there to gather facts and go where the evidence leads you. Is that, and I think that's what you're describing.
And I think
So,
that's what's most important to go into trial work, especially like, is because we get called by one side or the other, but we're there to tell you what happened and what we processed and the results of those processing. We're not here to fight anyone's battles. And so I think that causes a rift sometimes.
yeah. So when you got finally started to really look at this crime scene, what drew your attention first?
The shell casings, bottles, and potential blood spatter.
Okay. And let's talk about the shell casings first. What did you see? How many shell casings did you see?
Two shell casings originally.
And you said that there were three vehicles. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Do we know anything about like make, model, anything like that about those vehicles?
We have a Nissan Altima, a Dodge Charger, and I know we have a truck on scene, so I'm getting that.
Okay.
A Ram 1500.
And they're kind of parked in a row. Is that correct?
Yes.
Um,
It's
go ahead.
the truck. If you're facing towards the front ends of the vehicle, which were parked inwards, facing, I think that's southbound, but I can't tell from this angle. It would be the Ram on the left, the Altima in the middle, and then the Charger.
Okay, so would the charger be closest to Bay Street or farthest from?
Is so hard to tell. Hold on one second. Yes, the Charger is closest to Bay Street.
So, the shell casings that you're talking about, where were they in relation to those vehicles?
So the first shell casing is going to be on the sidewalk across from where the vehicles are. The second shell casing is between the Charger and the Altima, and then the third shell casing is between the Altima and the Ram.
Okay. And I know you're giving them one, two, three as the order. You have no idea how when these
I
shell
do not.
casings,
I
when
could
they were
not tell
shot.
you in what order they were fired.
The one you described as being on the sidewalk, is that like actually close to the post office building?
Yes, it
Okay.
is.
And the vehicles are parked, like if you pull into the parking lot, you can park facing the post office building or facing away from it, right?
Yes.
And the vehicles are parked facing away.
Correct.
So that shell casing being close to the building is kind of farther apart from the other two.
Yes, it's separated from all the other evidence that was collected.
Okay. Were those shell casings, what could you tell about them?
On the scene, I could tell you that they were fired shell casings.
Okay. And after the fact, did you do anything further with them? I'm guessing based on what you've said, testified, you're not under oath. You said they
Obviously.
object that they would have been something you processed for Niven as well.
Yes, so they should have been entered into Niven. I was not in Niven until 2017,
Oh, okay.
so I wouldn't be able to speak to that part.
Okay. Do you remember whether or not they were the same caliber or anything else?
Oh, let me see. 340 caliber shell casings.
Okay. Now those you said were among the first things you noticed. You said that there were bottles also.
Yes.
Just as a forensics person, why would bottles be important to you?
Because we could potentially get latents off of those bottles or DNA.
Okay. What kinds of bottles did you find?
We had Sprite bottles and one beer bottle.
Okay. And where were they?
We had one Sprite bottle sitting on the back of that Ram. And then we had on the passenger side of the Ram, we had a beer bottle in a bag. And then we had on the other side of the wall, we had another Sprite bottle and another beer bottle.
So you're describing a wall. When I was looking at the pictures, it's such a hard thing to describe with words, but I'm trying to like maybe do it for you. I'm not particularly articulate about it, but you've got the vehicles are all facing away from the building, away from the post office building. There's almost like a drop off, isn't there? Like,
It's an
is that
elevated parking lot from the main roadway.
okay, so is that the wall you're talking about, that kind of drop-off thing?
Yes. So the vehicles are parked facing towards this drop-off, which is towards the roadway, and it's a brick-styled drop-off. And then there's a grassy area and then the sidewalk of the main road. And so on that grassy area, directly below the drop-off, is where we see the Sprite and the beer bottle.
Okay. And when we're talking about that drop off or that little wall area, it's not super tall, right?
Correct.
It's the kind of thing that it'd be fairly easy to jump up and down from.
Right. If I had to guess, I would say 4 feet tall.
Okay. So we're not talking about like a 12-foot tall wall, just a few feet.
Correct.
Okay. So you've got four bottles that you are hoping to get something from. You've
Yes.
got shell casings, and you said there was blood.
And there was what looked to be blood between the vehicles.
Okay. And do you remember between which two vehicles?
It's between the Altima and the Ram.
Okay. So after you do basically this overview, what kind of processing is involved there at the scene? Or ideally, what would the processing be like?
So after the walkthrough, where we identify what evidence is going to be relevant, which evidence is not necessary, we will do photography for this specific type of crime scene. There, again, we said that different scenes require different types of processing. So next would be after identifying evidence, you would go into photography and you would want to document everything that way. And then once you have the scene photographed, you're going to put down evidence markers. And then you would re-photograph everything. And when you do photography with crime scenes, you're going to do different types of photos. So you'll do your overalls, which will give hopefully the jury one day good idea of what the scene looked like because you have to be their eyes. They can't see what you're seeing that night. Then you would go into mediums and close-ups. So you use mediums as a way to reference the scene and the evidence to give them an idea of where this evidence was located on the crime scene. And then you're going to move into a close-up to give them the finer details.
Okay. Were you able to complete all of that from a photography standpoint, at least?
Yes.
Okay. What happened then?
Then we would typically tow the vehicles and collect the evidence.
And that would be typical for any kind of shooting case, is that right? Like an aggravated assault, like we have here.
Yes.
Did that happen in this case?
It did not.
Why?
the case was handed off to a different unit. And so different units, like we said, different crimes will be processed different ways.
Okay. And who made the decision not to tow the vehicles?
My report says Detective Samuels.
Okay. So, and that was robbery unit, correct?
Yes, correct.
So how did that, how could that, let's just say in a hypothetical sense, how could that have affected your ability to process these vehicles if you were planning to process them?
So different detectives will tell me different ways or different things that they think should be processed depending on what kind of a crime it is. And if they don't feel that something is relevant for the kind of crime that we're working, then it's we don't process it from the most part unless we decide that we're going to do it anyways. Because we feel that it is important.
So,
Or so we know that someone might get the case later who will find that it is very important, and we don't want to feel the wrath of that person.
are we talking about someone named
I don't know
Santoro?
what you're referring to, but he lives far away from me, and he can't scare me anymore.
On, you're not really scared of Rob
No,
anyway.
absolutely not. He is a wonderful person to work with, and I'm really sad that I don't get to anymore because he taught me a lot and he was an incredible detective and I learned a lot from him. So I miss him.
I
His
believe you.
dedication is like unparalleled.
I agree. Although you've got on here Michelle Shiro, and
Michelle's my OG mentor, so like she's up
yeah,
here.
absolutely. And having worked cases with Michelle where she did stuff that was well above and beyond
Oh
any
my gosh,
forensic
like some of the
person.
stuff that she could think about, I was like, oh, that's incredible that like she even thought to do that. You know what I mean? Like it was
It's
awesome.
awesome.
I got my first subpoena and I ran to her office. I was like, what do I do? And she like breaks out a book and she's like, here, read this book. It's a manual on how to testify. And then I think I sat with her for like the next 3 hours and she like walked me through all the ways to be the most professional and efficient testimony
Works. It
ever.
worked. It worked.
I was
And that's
very
awesome.
blessed with that.
I love that. So you was there anything that you made that kind of decision about, like, hey, I really want to just like tow this and process it anyway at this crime scene, or were you just thinking that way?
I remember it, and when reading back my report, I am reminded of it. I will quote this because it said he advised he would not be needing the bottles I collected, and I advised I would keep them due to ever-changing circumstances. Because too many times the chain scene changes, and then we're looked at like, why didn't you do this? And I'm like, and I don't feel like it's an appropriate response to say, well, nobody told me to, or nobody made me do that because I'm capable of making that judgment. Yes.
I'm so to hear you say that. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I just have to say, because I agree with everything Jenna said, she did a great job, it sounds like. And when you talk about different detectives telling you different things at different scenes, you have to remember that some of these detectives just became detectives like a few months ago. And they suddenly think they know everything. And a lot of them, I admire their tenacity and their gung-ho spirit, and but they don't know everything. And when you have been in forensics long enough that you've been to the classes, you've worked a lot of crime scenes, and then, oh, here's a new detective who just got into the unit after being in the department for like 18 months, but now they're a detective and now they're going to come to the scene and tell you how to do your job. Bless their little hearts. But, like Jenna said, if you see something that you know really could be good evidence down the road, I agree. I would grab it anyway, and I'd be like, well, I think I'm just gonna take it, and I'll just log it in, or I'll lock it up, or whatever. And yeah, I mean, if that was one thing that used to just irritate the crap out of me, is a rookie detective coming in telling you, oh, we don't need that, or do this, or do that, or do that. And it's like, well, why? Give me some kind of logical, rational reason why you want me to do this. And they're like, oh, I saw this at some kind of a homicide seminar that I went to last week, and it looks really cool. Okay, how's that relevant to this case? Well, I just want you to do it. Well, no, I'm not doing that. That's stupid. And then, fast forward 2 years into the future, defense attorney is going to ask you, well, why did you do this at the scene? And I hate when a forensic person would say, well, that's what the detective told me to do. Because you have a good brain in your head, use it. It didn't make sense. Why are you doing this? And if you show so little thought that you can't think for yourself, you're just going to be a garbage collector, and you're just going to pick up everything because they tell you that, oh, I just want it. Well, why? Well, just in case.
Well, and you, I kind of want to pause here too, because we have like these kind of weird situations. And I know, Michelle, you worked a case with Rob that I actually had you on for that involved a cup, a styrofoam cup
Oh yeah, that
from
was such a good
the
one. Oh
track.
they were
That ended up, and
plastic.
that, like, this was like the coolest thing. We actually had an episode about this that talked about how you can get both DNA and fingerprints off of a styrofoam cup months, I mean years after the fact. So I feel fairly certain that Rob Santoro may or may not have been that guy. I actually know for a fact that he was that guy on crime scene saying, hey, do this.
Yeah, no, but I mean that's a different scenario though, because there was a way to link those particular cups through witness testimony. So
Right, but
that's a
no
key.
one knew that night of. I mean, I don't think people were paying attention to that kind of minutia the night of. And that was another cold case that Rob ended up working, but God bless Mark Allgaier, he actually like collected
Yeah.
all this stuff.
But I kind of think that though that there was some kind of a link, because the person had been seen drinking cups around that particular area and tossing them in there, because I don't think Mark would have just collected it for no good reason.
No, look, there was a reason. The problem was that, like, this was a guy who killed a bouncer at Sharon's Lounge. And so there were like 10,000 cups. I mean, it was an absurd number of cups. And I need to sit down with Mark at some point and have a discussion about this. But that, it can go both ways, but it also goes both ways in Jenna's situation here, because you collect those bottles for potential fingerprints and DNA, and fingerprints are definitely something that you all can independently start working on, right? But you have to have an actual search warrant and known DNA and stuff like that. It's fairly rare that you're going to do a DNA run through CODIS on something from a bottle. Am I wrong? Like, you're not going to swab the bottle and put that swab in and see if it's like running through CODIS or anything.
We don't personally, we'll swab it, but we send it, like, it will get sent off to the lab based on the judgment of the detective.
Right. So
But,
that you need that cooperation, investigative cooperation from your
right.
detective, particularly for DNA work.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The DNA, like, if I swab DNA and they don't find it relevant, like, it's just going to sit there. But another thing that I think was one of the challenges of bringing up things at crime scenes that you don't agree with is that, which not everybody feels like this, but as a female and one of the youngest people and one of the newest people, it was hard to look at people who had maybe been there longer and be like, no, you're wrong. So I would more phrase it as a question, like, oh, well, what do you think if we did this? Or maybe we should do this, like, just in case, because it was just, we could still get to the same conclusion without being confrontational, which was one of the things that I was terrible at, it's a confrontation. So I would just try to phrase it in a way that made them feel like part of the decision-making process.
That is a really good skill that you had very, or have very young. Just always came across as this god-awful confessional bitch,
I think
which
you mean that as an attorney is to be aggressive. Like you as attorney, I don't know how you guys do it. That's not my jam. But like it's very impressive that you're just able to be confrontational. I wish I had that strength. It's just not for me.
Yeah, but it is not necessarily something that you get accolades for all over
Well, you
the
should.
So it sounds like I should have been an attorney.
You
You would
look,
have made an excellent attorney.
both
There's
of you would
like
be in different ways, and that's again, I'm going on a tangent, but I do think that being yourself as a witness or as an attorney is going to come across as a lot more credible than trying to be something that you're not. And so I'm not good at pretending that I'm sweetness and light, and I'm not going to.
it's hard to be serious on the stand when I want to diffuse the tension. It's not.
And again, that it's not dishonest or whatever to just come at it in a gentler manner. It's not like you're not being confrontational. You're confronting what the issue is. You're just not making someone feel uncomfortable about it. So that I think that that's a good set of skills to have, whether I have learned to use them or not. So at this scene, Jenny, you make the call, like, I'm keeping these bottles anyway. Obviously you're keeping the shell casings,
Yes.
but you don't get the cars. I'm like, oh my God, really? No, what happened?
Yes. I don't know if anyone would have listened to me if I said we're keeping the cars. I don't write the search warrants. So it really I needed to rely on their expertise and their decision making because it's their case at that moment. And if they felt that that wasn't necessary, then I'm probably not calling their boss and telling them otherwise.
Well, and I understand it from a robbery detective's standpoint. I'm not making excuses for them because I honestly feel like this is part of the reason we have so many unsolved armed robberies in Savannah. But they have this kind of triage that they do too. Like, how easy is this going to be to solve? And if it's going to be easy, we'll do some stuff up front. If it's not going to be easy, it's going to go on the pile of 10,000 unsolved armed robberies. So the release of the vehicles, you've got four surviving victims at this point who are all from Hinesville. How else are they going to get home? That kind of thing. So, and fortunately, I guess, and that might be part of the reason why, but like they get released, but you're still eventually able to process some of the vehicles. How did that happen?
I guess that the vehicles were located and able to be towed to the annex anyways at a different point. And I'm not sure what triggered that,
Okay.
because my involvement was pretty much the crime scene.
Okay. So you did the crime scene. It gets released, and then you're done for the night, right?
Correct. I'll go back and I'm not sure if I wrote my report that night, but we packaged the evidence, we processed anything that needs to be processed, and then we're done with the case for the most part.
Okay. So that's pretty much what happened here. Did you later find out the victim had died?
Yes.
And obviously, these vehicles are brought in, or at least two of the three vehicles are brought in. However, they got there, and Detective Santoro comes in, and he's raging, I would imagine, having witnessed this on one or two occasions.
Yes.
And Michelle gets involved. Is that
apparently,
right?
as was typical with Detective Santoro, he knew I was a pushover, so when he had something like this, he'd call me up.
He called you up personally?
Probably. He called me for the cup thing while I was working off duty.
Oh, that's right. You actually ran all that stuff while you were working off duty at your off-duty job.
No, he called me to that one time just to ask about, hey, can we get DNA and fingerprints off of cups that have been sitting in the property room for a year or more? You know, he'd just throw these hypothetical questions at me. I'm like, oh man, I don't know where this is going. You know? So usually if he had something, he knew that I was a nerd, and so if he wanted to do something that he figured everybody else would say no to, he'd be like, oh, I'll call Michelle. Michelle will do it. Kind of like Mikey. Mikey Elite Life.
Well, and some of that was true for Mikey Hendricks too, but so
Oh
you
no,
get
I meant Mikey from the Life commercials, you know, the
Life
cereal.
cereal.
Yeah, Mikey ate it. Yeah, he'd call me because he knew I was kind of a nerd for that. I'd be like, I don't know, let's try it out. Let's see.
Awesome. That's just awesome. So you get involved and the cars are there at the annex. Is that right?
Yes.
So what did you do at that point?
So much like Jenna talked about with the scene photography, by the time the vehicles get towed to our secure location at the annex, they're locked up in a controlled environment. But still, because I'm walking into this kind of in the middle, I may or may not know anything about the case. I may know that it's just a homicide case, but I don't get a lot of details like Jenna. But I mean, I grab my camera and I love working vehicles. So I'll go out and, you know, just like she said, I'll treat that like my scene. I'm photographing the vehicles as I find them, first on the exterior before we touch anything. We always work from least intrusive to most intrusive. So we always start with that photography, exterior, then the interior. If we have the ability to get in, if we have keys, sometimes we need to call Papa-Lok. Sometimes we wait for the warrant, you know, whatever the case may be. And then once the photography is done, and again, inside, we're not touching anything, we're just photographing it as we find it. And then once that's done, then we can start the processing. And in a case like this, I will take an abundance of photographs, especially with all the fingerprints where they're located. A lot of times that'll help me later on when I need to kind of, when I'm doing the analysis part of it, and I'm like, okay, what part of the vehicle was this part on? And how was this place? How was it oriented? What direction is this facing? So the photographs will help with that.
So, you got two vehicles here. And obviously, we had three on scene and we only have two to process. But the two are a Nissan Altima and a Dodge Charger, right?
Sure.
Sure.
I mean, I saw the pictures. I didn't look at the makes and models, but
So, you started with photographing and I absolutely love this because when we were like talking before we got started, Jenna was, you all were both talking about the quality of the photographs, which I gotta tell you makes an enormous difference in the courtroom. Jenna's gesturing.
they were amazing.
That is a real skill. Like, we all kind of take for granted, like, oh, everyone can take pictures on their phone, like, no big deal. It really isn't like that.
The quality is so different, especially if you're just talking about phone to actually using a camera. The quality is completely different. And then if you get a skilled photographer who has taken classes, who has experience, who has done the work to become a good photographer, you can clearly see the differences in the photos. And I'm sure with your experience, you know, you get certain cases and some photos are probably going to be better than others.
Oh yeah.
Especially when you're trying to show a jury what it looked like that night, it is so important to have quality photos.
Well, and I'm being honest here, Jenna. The crime scene photos here are also excellent, and I have seen crime scene photos that are like, "What happened here?" Where you have absolutely no idea. Your shell casings are blurry. It's really, it's a skill, and it's one that you really cannot downplay. I know that a lot of people do, but it's a mistake. Because we've got just so much detail on these, and it's cool looking at it because I'm not a fingerprint examiner, obviously. That's what Michelle is incredibly well trained for. But when you even look at the photographs of the latent she's able to pull up, it's almost like you can see the rich detail on some of these photos.
Yeah, if you had to, and that's the thing I think of as the examiner, because I'm the one that has to look at this ultimately. I tend to always shoot my photographs in a very high resolution, a very high quality photo, so that if I had to work just from the photograph, I could. So if you screw up during the tape lifting process, you can go back to the photo and you could use the photograph to actually do the comparison.
Damn.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, and we've already talked about it, the amount of skill that it takes to do this. How many, like, both of y'all took classes, but that's also like expertise on the street. How long does it take to get really good at taking like high-res photographs like you're talking about?
It really shouldn't take that long if it's something that you really want to do. I will tell you that in terms of processing, you are going to run the gamut of talent level and skill level with your techs. Some of them are picking up these cameras for the first time, and these are very expensive cameras, and they don't know one end from the other, and they put it on green box and think they're going to shoot their whole scene with it, and you get crappy photos.
What do you
And
mean by Reeboks? I don't even know what you're talking
oh, green
about.
box. It's like the if you look at the dial on a camera, there's a green box, which is basically automatic, and you just it's like a point and shoot, like
I
a cell
gotcha.
phone. You just kind of push the button and you let the camera make all your exposure choices. But GIPSTC, we talked about it earlier, Georgia Public Safety Training Center offers a week-long photography class, which is one of those classes Jenna talked about earlier, where you take this digital single lens reflex camera out and you do all kinds of exercises to understand your camera settings, to understand the resolution, the manual settings, the aperture settings, the shutter speeds and the film speeds and all of this. You learn all of this so that you can take pictures in all different types of conditions, lighting conditions. And if you have someone who doesn't go to the class or they don't really pick it up, I mean, then you're gonna get crappy pictures. So, I had done photography years ago at the junior college in California when I was trying to take a 2-year class on evidence technology, technician actually. And I had taken a bunch of photo classes for that degree that I never finished, but I loved it. Absolutely loved it. So when we switched over to digital, because those were all film classes, but when I took the digital, I actually took one of the guys out in the parking lot. You remember Dennis Malott? He took me out in the back parking lot, and I said, "Hey, just kind of refresh my memory on these cameras because I need to be able to confidently shoot with it." And it's like riding a bicycle. I remembered everything, and I just love it. I really, really enjoy it. So that's why I would much rather shoot a scene on a tripod to heck with the flash, unless I absolutely need it. So I really get into it. But you have some people who don't, and they brag about taking 10 pictures for a homicide scene. And
Oh, wow. No, don't do that to me.
it was a long time ago, long, long time ago before I ever came. So I not throwing shade at anybody that's currently there or has been there my entire time, long time ago.
Okay. That
Well,
would
also nighttime photography is a whole nother beast. And
Yes.
I think patience goes a lot into photography and checking your camera every single time you take a photo. Is it blurry? Am I capturing what I want it to? Is it getting those fine details? Do I need to do something different? And what I communicated to the camera appear in the photo that I wanted. So I it and you're if you're taking 200, 250 photos for a homicide case, then that takes time. And so if you don't have the patience or you're feeling rushed or whatever the situation is, then it's going to be reflected in your photos.
Again, this is the kind of investigative legwork that no one thinks about. It's like, the hours that you spend going through text messages, and that kind of stuff from someone's phone. The time that it takes to do it right makes all the difference. And I'm looking at these pictures and they are fantastic. And like I was talking about ridge detail. Can we do a really quick summary of what a fingerprint person is looking for when you're looking at a vehicle like this and you process it and you dusted it, right? Is that fair, Michelle?
Yes.
So this looks like, in my layman's terms, like graphite powder or something. Is that right or not?
Yes, it's a standard black powder. You can get just about any of the vendors will sell it, like Searchy, Linn PV, Lightning Powder. There's a bunch out there. So it's just your standard black powder. I think the vehicle was white, or at least a very light color. Which is my favorite color to work with when you have black powder, right? Because it just jumps out at you like neon. It just really slaps you in the face. It's great. So you start putting your fiberglass brush in the powder, and then you're processing the vehicle, and this stuff just jumps out at you, and it's like, I'm not sure what to compare it to, but it's just everywhere you put your brush down, it's like your Midas. Everything you touch turns to gold, and it's just there was so much to work with.
You found a lot of latent prints, or it looks like a lot, on this white vehicle.
Yes.
What do you do? Like, you photographed it, obviously. There seem to be like almost like fingerprints, palm prints, whatever, overlapping. Does that make a difference to you?
It does make it a little more challenging. But it's still can be worked with depending on how bad it is. These were pretty decent, so
So you did, obviously the initials don't have any kind of powder or anything on them. You dust the exterior, then you photograph the whole thing again, and then what do you do?
well. I'm thinking about how many dang lift cards I'm gonna need because I'm tape lifting all of this, and I'm using palm size tape, which is kind of challenging to work with. It's about 4 inches. The card's about 4 inches wide, so I'm trying to figure out because some of them, like you say, there's a couple of them that are overlapping, and you're figuring out how the heck am I gonna capture all this on one lift. I think I probably turned in between 20 and 30 cards. But yeah, you just start from one section and you kind of work your way around the vehicle and hope you got everything.
So you tried to tape lift all of these prints?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You talk also about like palm size versus what? What are your other options when you're lifting?
Well, versus just a fingerprint, which your tape might be only maybe a half inch wide or an inch wide tape, and it goes all the way up to 4 inches wide. So you just, if you can catch the fingers in there with the palms, you might lift them all on the palm tape. It kind of just depends on whoever's processing and how they want to lift it. It's nice if you can lift what we call simultaneous impressions together on one strip of tape, like a palm size tape. Simultaneous meaning like you put all your fingers down together at the same time, so you get that relationship from the index to the middle and the middle to the ring and the ring to the pinky, so you can kind of figure out which finger is which, and you can usually tell then which hand it is, right or left. So, yeah, you're kind of thinking this, planning it out, and seeing is it going to fit on one card? Do I need two cards? If you had to, you could put multiple strips of tape down and put it on a dang white sheet of paper if you had to, and turn that in. I've seen them turn in some crazy things, but as long as you get it onto a substrate, it's I can look at it.
So Just while I'm looking at this, and I hadn't really thought about the logistics of lifting these, but you'd mentioned when you were talking about photographing these as accurately and high res as possible. Now I'm starting to really understand like all the things that can go wrong in the lifting process, because I never really thought about that. So what can happen in the lifting process that's going to screw this up?
Well, you could have the wind blow and tape could fold in on itself. Yeah, exactly. You could have somebody happens to distract you and you put the tape down wrong, or you get a bubble somewhere or a crease. So yeah, there are 50 ways to screw up your tape lift.
Wow. You said you got a, like 30 lifts from this.
Oh, probably at least.
Yeah, it looks like there probably were like more of that, more than
It
that.
was probably an inch and a half to a 2-inch stack of Leighton cards that I pulled out for this case.
And then what do you do?
As the processor, I make sure they're all filled out properly, and then I turn them into myself.
So, and when you're talking about filled out properly, does that talk about like the location from where on the vehicle it was lifted, those kinds of things, the orientation that you mentioned before?
Yes, because like in the moment, to expedite, I'm putting the tape lift on the card, and then I'll put a quick notation, like where it's coming from, passenger side, front hood, over the tire, something like that, and then I'll draw a quick diagram in the box to show where it came from, and then I move on to the next one. And so by the when I'm done, then I'll go back and I'll fill in like the case report number, my name, my initials, payroll. The date, all that other stuff.
Okay.
And just to emphasize, like, why that's so important is because I had a case where I had to testify about the orientation of a handprint that I had picked up. And it was I think it was a stolen vehicle case or something like that. And people always want to say, oh, well, I leaned up against the car and that's why. But the orientation and how the fingers were on the vehicle, you could tell that they were trying to pull the window down. And so that's why it was so important to document like where exactly and what orientation
Right.
the fingerprints are happening.
Right. And again, you know, that's the whole point, right? We have like all of this forensic evidence to basically tell the story. It's a fact. So yeah, the fact, the facts are something that I love forensic evidence because again, it can make or break your case one way or another. So you take all these tape lifts, Michelle. And you turn them into yourself, and then what do you do?
So then I already was very excited because these prints were really great. So I was already lifting them, going, oh man, this is going to be great. I can't wait to run this in APHIS. So I get them back to the office, I log them into my book, and then I basically get started. And I'm looking at all these prints and I'm scanning them in and running them through APHIS and having a good time with that. And then
Nerd.
I
Say it wasn't me this time.
completely accept that and wait for the screen to return me my lovely candidates.
And we've talked about APHIS before, but just briefly. So, APHIS does what?
APHIS stands for Automated Fingerprint Identification System, and it is a lot like the NIBIN database that Jenna talked about earlier because it's a database that has basically millions and millions of known prints in the system. So basically, anytime you get arrested, you get fingerprinted for that arrest and your prints go into that database. So there are millions of prints in there. I am searching an unknown latent print, and the system that I use, the program that I use, it maps out an algorithm on the print based on the location of the different minutiae within that print, like ending ridges and bifurcations. It creates that algorithm, and don't ask me about that. I profess no knowledge to that algorithm. But it goes off to search to Georgia, and then it will I usually would search Georgia first because, you know, we don't have a lot of our folks are local. So I'll start with Georgia. And then if I don't get anything back and it's a really awesome print, then I absolutely will search against the national database through the Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification, IAFIS, which is now, of course, NGI, because now they incorporate other biometrics in that. So NGI is now the new term. And of course, now that you're going to put me on the spot, I'm thinking I can't remember now what
Yeah.
NGI is, but
I
anyway.
was thinking, yeah, that's kind of
Yeah.
a
No,
new one.
next generation identification. There we go.
So, well, you said it includes other biometrics. What are we talking about?
Well, I think they do iris scans now
Oh.
and maybe retinal or iris, facial identity. I think that's incorporated in there now too. So I'm only concerned with the fingerprint part. So again, if they're not coming back in George's system, then I will run them up against the FBI's system and see if we have somebody visiting from out of state and run it that way.
Well, and of course, Savannah being where it is, a lot of people don't know where we are. We are right across the river from South Carolina. So, you know, the chances of having, and we're very close to Florida as well, chances of somebody from being from out of state here is not outrageous. So,
Exactly,
certainly
yes.
possible. And where this happened is pretty close to the bridge from South Carolina. So, it is not out of the realm here. But you ran it. In this case, you ran our prints.
Oh, I ran a bunch, yeah.
What'd you find?
So I don't have a copy of the report in front of me. So because I
Man.
can't, you know, I don't
I know.
really have access to that anymore. So
Understood.
I retired.
We'll forgive you.
They don't really like me going into my old office and making myself at home anymore.
Bet they would. I bet
Well,
they'd let
yeah.
you.
People will be stoked to see you.
Yes. So you got some information, though. Like are you familiar with some of the matches that were, or a match that was done in this case?
I know that I did have one to Mr. Lee, and I kind of want to say I ID'd the victim as well. Again,
Hakeem Clark.
yeah, I again without my files, I'm not. I just remember Mr. Lee was in there.
Do you know? My recollection is there is a match to a right fingerprint, one of his fingers. I can't remember.
I think it was right middle and the right ring.
See, there you go.
Yeah.
And those were found where?
driver's side door, actually exterior driver's side door.
Okay. I, of course, have like professed that there was a palm print that matched to him, and now you're starting to rebut that presumption of that
Well,
thing.
yeah, I just can't really confirm or deny at this point. I don't have it
Okay.
in front of me.
And it's fine. Again, it may be a situation where I'm remembering wrong, or it may be like maybe it's Hakeem Clark's palm print. I don't know. There's certainly a lot of palm prints that we can see them. Going across the hood of the car, right?
Yes.
Was there also some suspected blood here?
Yes.
Can you, and I know we looked at the pictures earlier, like the suspected blood, where do we have that on this vehicle?
Jenna, do you remember that picture
On
on the pad?
the rear passenger above door frame. So it's
Driver
like
side, passenger side.
on the passenger side, on the rear, in the like almost the C post. It's like the top morphing into the C post of the vehicle.
Are you talking, you are talking about the inside one or the outside?
Can you see this?
Yeah, throw that up.
Okay.
I know we had one on the inside. It was on one of the hand grips above the
Yeah.
door.
Yep, we have that as well.
That one was on the inside, and then there was like an outside, like a swipe that was
Yeah, this is the outside one right here.
Okay, so there's an outside one on the outside of the, like
I
right
think
above
that's
the.
the passenger side back seat. Yes. Yep.
Okay. And the inside was on a inside like upper door handle, is that right?
Yes, passenger side upper door handle.
Okay.
Back seat, yeah, front seat, right? Because there's the visor. Yeah.
Yeah, the passenger's front seat.
Yep.
Okay. And of course those y'all swapped them. Yes, or you swapped them, I should say, Michelle.
Most likely. I don't see blood and not play with it.
That sounds really morbid. But so I feel certain that you did swab it. I'm just not sure that that was ever submitted in any way, because I don't know that we got DNA from our suspect here. And I don't know there's any evidence from that anyone other than our victim was bleeding, to my knowledge. So you also processed the charge, and I only want to mention it just because this is such a pickup vehicle. I'm sorry, it's like the coolest So you've got like this, it is a chick magnet kind of car. It's got what, red leather seats, all this stuff going on. But you also found some defects in this vehicle. Am I right about that? Were there things that were thought to be bullet defects or gunshot defects? Oh, yeah, there's the Courvoisier. I'm sorry, I forgot about that. Rosé Courvoisier. There's a weapon inside that's holstered. And there's some defects in the exterior of the car, I think.
Yes, rear bumper.
Rear bumper, okay. And I think, yeah, there's one other.
This one looks like it's the backlight.
Okay. So when you see defects like that, you actually showed me something that was really cool I didn't know existed. So what do you do when you're trying to figure out what may have caused that?
So at that time, we had these lead presumptive ampules, I guess you could call them. And we started using those around the time that we had Chief Burko for 3 years with Metro. And I really liked him because there were a lot of times when you would see a hole in something, for example, in this case, the bumper, and you kind of want to be able to say, is this involved somehow with the shooting, or is this from some other kind of defect, like maybe a like you backed into something? We want to at least answer that question. So we pull out these lead presumptive kits, and you take out one of these ampules, and it's one of these things where you just like break the ampule in the middle, and then this liquid comes out, and you dab it onto this suspected hole or bullet hole, and then if it tests positive for lead, it turns pink. So these things have come in really handy when we have had incidents where a detective, perhaps one of these younger ones that have been to a seminar, and they see all these defects, and they're like, "Oh, this house got shot up." And you're like, "No, I don't think so." And they're like, "Yeah, we think so. We're gonna have you do this, that, and the other." And I'm like, "Wait a minute, let me break out one of these lead presumptive kits." And I explain what it is, and I start dabbing this house, and nothing's popping up. And they're like, "Oh." Sometimes it saves you some work.
Well, right. So, but in this case, we've got the actual reaction that you would, these are created to test for, which is they've got the lead presumptive on your suspected bullet holes. Do you follow up on that? I mean, do you start digging around looking for bullets, or what happens?
You may, depending on where it is in the vehicle. Sometimes you literally cannot retrieve a slug because it's buried too deep into something, or you might tear something apart so bad. And so you then, you'll let the detective know and say, hey, how crazy do you want me to get tearing this item apart to get this bullet out? And it just depends what they want. If it's something you can easily retrieve, we'll go ahead and get it, but you just kind of have to weigh how important it is. A lot of times, I think Jenna can speak to this. Doesn't the shell casing give you sometimes more information than even the slug? Because the slug could be so damaged, you're not going to get any rifling out of it.
A lot of times, and we have to send that out just like we send blood work out to a lab. But when you could damage it by digging it out, and they're very fragile, so whatever they're going through is all likely going to alter them. And the shell casing just gets ejected out of the firearm. So unless it gets run over, we're probably getting more information from that.
Yeah, I've seen crime scenes where the shell casings got run over by, say, the ambulance. Things happen.
Priorities, people's
Yeah,
lives. Yep.
not much you can do about that one.
Yep.
Just you can explain. Look, we had people dying, and so yeah, that's definitely crucial information. I'm just sitting here thinking to myself, like, if this case had not been a homicide, if someone had not actually died, and of course, this whole investigation, this whole podcast is about like justice and that kind of thing. But there were flaws in this because if it hadn't been a homicide, we wouldn't have had those vehicles and we wouldn't have these fingerprints and we wouldn't have this additional information that I think is so critical to actually solving it. So first of all, I commend you all for being like so important to the process. I mean, I can't tell you how important it is to have you guys do your job and do it as diligently as you do. But I'm just, is it me? Am I misinterpreting the importance of like getting it right at the crime scene, like night of?
Well, one of the issues can be if a crime scene isn't secure, that evidence can potentially be argued against at trial later. So if I come to a crime scene and the crime scene tape isn't up, or the crime scene is set to be too small based on the crime scene tape, like that can create issues if we have to expand it or we find evidence outside of that. So if it's not secure, that can create issues later down the line.
Yeah, for sure. So, Michelle, do you have anything that you want to add to that?
I mean, I'm just literally off the top of my head thinking of two major, very high profile cases where scene security absolutely just was a huge factor. To Jenna's point, the McDonald case, Jeffrey McDonald case, where he murdered his family on an army base, and Army CID was just all over the place, and it was a rainy night, and they jacked up the entry point of entry. And then the JonBenet Ramsey case, which probably
Yes.
everyone's heard of that one. They were, like Jenna said, the scenes changed, and initially they thought it was a kidnapping. And so everybody was in the house, walking all over the place, doing whatever they pleased. And then they decided to check the house later, and then they found her, and they let dad bring her upstairs. I mean, yeah, it's happened before, and it'll happen again.
I just hope that, if we have law enforcement folks or prosecutors or whatever listening to this, please take into account that your forensic people have a job to do and it takes time. I mean, it just, the amount of time you're talking about to get good photographs and having had the experience of probably, I would say, more crime scene photographs than not, like the preponderance of the crime scene photographs I've seen, most of them are not anywhere near this level. I mean, there's a huge percentage that are not anywhere near this level of like clarity, and I'm talking both at the crime scene and in the processing. Both of y'all do an excellent job with the photos, but when you have jacked up photos, yeah, it is so hard because again, when I'm presenting them to a jury, I don't want to have to be like lightening them up because it looks like you're distorting something. I mean, it's obvious. Like, I don't want to have to be in a situation where I have to explain, hey, because you couldn't see anything, it's like black.
And you know the defense attorney will bring it up.
Of
So,
course, of course. And you don't want to be in that situation.
yeah.
So, while, yes, it's a digital image and, the lighting can be adjusted digitally after the fact, it looks, you've got to explain that and you've got to notify people of that. That's like, potentially a Brady violation from our end. It's a legal thing where you have to disclose any alteration you've made. So I feel like getting it right the first time, as both of you have said and both of you have done, it's critical. And I feel like we're just seeing these departments get so overloaded that the quality of what we're doing is getting lost in the desire to like produce quantity. Does that make
Well,
sense?
you to your point about how long things take, like I remember crime scenes that spanned several blocks because someone was shot and then they were bleeding and they were running. And so you think about the amount of time, not just to photograph something, but to process it, to swab it, to make sure you collect everything, nothing was missed. Are there people in the scene? Is it a heavily trafficked area and you're shutting it down during a heavily trafficked time of day also? So like so many factors go into it. Is it shift change? How many people do we have available? And like you, when Michelle was talking about like how many people are in the crime scene, because you think, better, more eyes on something, more hands to collect something, but that's not the situation in forensics. You generally want to have fewer people in there, fewer people to contaminate what you need to collect and process.
And then there's the time factor in terms of, do you have Waters Ave shut down for 4 blocks because it was a running gun battle and people are just still trying to get from point A to point B? So now you need officers diverting traffic and keeping that section closed. And you have, higher ups going, hey, we have another shooting over on the other side of town. Can you guys hurry up and finish this? Because we need to go to the next one. That's happened before too, where you get, Friday, Saturday night, and you've got a shooting over here, a baby death over here, another shooting over here, you have a suicide over there, and you're just overwhelmed. And there's two of you on the street, or one of you is wanting to clock out at midnight, and you're stuck with the other ones, and you're like having to maybe call somebody out. I mean, I don't remember if it was 2015 or 16. One of those years we had like a record number of homicides. It was like the summer of death, and it
Yes.
was just you knew you were going to be riding a homicide. I mean, you just kind of counted on it, and it was sometimes crazy. So that also goes into, how much time can you take to work this scene? Do you have the time to do it right? Oh, my SD card is full, or I lost my battery, or my battery's dead, or I need another flashlight. I mean, all this, can somebody bring me another one? I mean, it can be crazy. It can get really crazy. And sometimes you're thinking, well, shoot, I didn't have dinner and I'm starving and I'm thirsty and
I'm drenched in sweat.
I'm miserable. It's raining, a million things. And so then you wonder why sometimes your pictures don't look the best, but
I'm amazed y'all
I
don't curse more. I
am
just I, I'm impressed.
not right now. Well, and
Thanks.
scientifically, as soon as the scene is created, it begins to break down and deteriorate. And so, like, time is of the essence, especially with Savannah crazy weather. Like, those storms can come in at any time. So, you have to be ready for that random storm to come through.
Oh shoot, I had that today. Walked out of court and the skies opened up. Yay. And I have no umbrella.
You're
Wonderful.
like, I, this was not in the weather forecast.
No.
So, You mentioned Christy earlier. You mentioned Mark Allgaier, and he and I were partners while I was on the street. So you and the crazy weather, it was summertime, and we had two homicides 2 days in a row, literally the same case report number with the exception of the date. So
Oh,
that's freaky. But it was
yeah.
the second one was a body dump out on Hutchinson Island. So we were both racing to get out there. And it literally cropped up and rained really hard for like, I don't know, 10 minutes. And then it was clear again and hot and steamy. And when I got there, Mark already had his camera around his neck, and I was fixing to yell at him because we had an arrangement. I do photography and he did video. So I was yelling at him, and he's like, "Hey, dummy, this is a dirt road, and we were about to lose some tire impressions because there wasn't a lot of vehicle traffic out there." So he had the foresight to grab his camera real quick and take some pictures of some potential tire impressions before I got there. And because if we'd waited for me, they would have been lost. So,
Wow.
that's awesome.
yeah,
That is
weather.
awesome. And well, right. I mean, so much of what you do is time sensitive and time consuming.
And you don't get a second chance. And that's the thing. We would want to hold a scene. And thankfully, I think it did get better over my time with the unit. It got better when we would tell them, "Hey, I need more time, give me another hour," whatever the case would be. I mean, sometimes, and Burko, I think, helped a lot with that because he would say, "You hold this scene as long as you need to get it done right." And when we had we had a homicide on Windsor Road, and we held that house for like 2 or 3 days. And I mean, we held Preston Phelps' house for probably 3 or 4 days. I mean, we had the ability to hold the scene as long as we needed it. So that did improve.
I think as people have seen firsthand how much it helps to have the forensic evidence in cases, and like especially with the CompStat meetings, I think we got to share so much information about how much that has helped certain cases that they were like, we should probably let them do their thing for the most part. So it was nice to feel that kind of support.
And that support comes and goes from leadership, doesn't it? That's not a consistent thing either. I'm grateful that, like, again, I feel like every time I get on here and talk with like y'all or with Rob or with some of the prosecutors that I was working with during that stretch of time, I'm so fortunate to have worked with so many incredibly talented and dedicated people. And you guys are definitely top of the list. I mean, just I'm amazed. I'm amazed at what you do. And I'm grateful that you were able to come on here. Is there anything else you think that we need to talk about that I've forgotten? No.
No, I can't think of anything.
Well, thank you, ladies. Obviously, had homicide investigators been involved with the crime scene investigation all the way through, the victims' vehicles would not have been released. As it is, the truck was never processed. But the excellent work of these forensics investigators gave us the critical identification of Quezon Lee's print on Hakeem Clark's car. Their work also corroborates the details Sa Agent Santoro later learned from Hakeem's friends. As you have heard, the case against Quezon Lee, both for the charges related to the murder and those related to the gang, were solid. How could this case get pled down? Our last episode in this series looks at system failure in the district attorney's office. Tune in if you can stand it.